Arsenal hosting Leicester, Manchester City against Tottenham. The margins between England's four best teams were so thin, the referees had to intervene. Along the way, we did get something we've rarely seen all season, the Premier League living up to the hype. Elsewhere, Liverpool and Chelsea broke out, Manchester United broke down, and Everton broke Valentine's hearts. Welcome everybody to this edition of the World Soccer Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's keep this intro as short as possible, though, guys. I want to welcome in my hosts, Lawrence McKenna and Kartik Krishner, because we have two amazing matches to talk about this weekend. Leicester City, undone after losing Danny Simpson to a second yellow card, lose at the Emirates 2-1, while Tottenham gets a late goal from Christian Eriksen to take a 2-1 win at the Etihad in Manchester. Lawrence, welcome back to the show. I want to know what your thoughts were on those two huge Sunday matchups.
Richard, they were title-defining. They were six-pointers.
It's February, I think. I think it's still February, Lawrence.
No, good point, yeah. We probably shouldn't get too far ahead of ourselves, should we? Yeah,
chronology is still a thing.
Chronology is still a thing, especially when the Champions League is coming back. I'm going to go down the route of pressure and tactics within the Premier League. I really enjoyed the way that Spurs were so almost openly let to pressure Man City. And then when Man City sort of turned to them and said, oh, wait a minute, you can't always pressure us. And Spurs said, okay, we'll concede a goal. and then when it went the other way, we sort of... I'm still fascinated with how the analysis with Arsenal generally centers around possession and how little they actually need possession as a side. Mm. And I think that's why it played out so well against Leicester in the end, because people sort of think, well, you know, it'll play into Leicester's hands, Arsenal like possession, etc. But actually, I think Wenger's so much more savvy than that. And that's why it took another twist this weekend.
Yeah, very interesting. We're going to talk about Arsenal, Leicester City in the first segment of the show. Devote the whole second segment to Manchester City and Tottenham. But Kartik, before we get there, just your thoughts on the two big matches on Sunday.
Yeah, epic matches. I think that certainly Leicester can feel a little bit hard done by the officiating. There's some controversy over the Vardy penalty, although I do think it was a foul. Now, did Vardy ham it up a little bit? Yes. But I think Leicester can feel hard done by the officiating. Manchester City versus Spurs, controversy about the officiating, but Spurs were the better team. They are the better team. They run out, deserve 3-point winners.
Yeah, the Vardy penalty discussion, I'm already rearing that a little bit, but we have to talk about it. It was an important moment. It was at least the first important moment in that match. But before even getting to these matches, I got to say, I've been as down on the Premier League as anybody that I know. I seem to be taking shots at the league throughout this whole season. Even during my intro, I took a shot at the league. But these two games were really excellent games this weekend. Four excellent performances by four teams that, to me, seem to distinguish themselves as the four best teams in the league, as if we didn't know that coming into the weekend. But I was extremely happy to wake up early for these games, and that was no small feat given the time zone that I'm in. It was a 3:50 wake-up for Arsenal-Leicester, but it was definitely worth it. So let's talk about that game first, gentlemen. Jamie Vardy converted a penalty kick just before halftime, gave Leicester a 1-0 lead. Danny Simpson gets two quick yellow cards in the second half, leaving Leicester to play most of the second stanza with 10 men. Theo Walcott, Danny Welbeck score Arsenal with a 2-1 victory. Lawrence, I'll go to you first. Just your thoughts on, well, let me just ask the obvious question. How do you think this game would have played out if Danny Simpson hadn't gotten his second yellow card?
Good question, actually. I think obviously it would have played more into Leicester's structure, which would have allowed them to sit back a little bit more on Arsenal. But I still think that would have meant that Arsenal would have at least got one goal, because the way that Giroud was playing in this game, I think it was probably one of his better games of the season.
He was great. He was great.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that really allowed them to apply the pressure. So even if Danny Simpson was on the pitch, I think that the way that they were using Giroud and the shape of the front line was really critical to the way that Arsenal were attacking. And the point would be that most Leicester fans, I think, were actually quite happy with how long they held up against Arsenal. For me, it was less about the sending off and more about how Leicester were playing the game. What I do wonder is, and let me just look back on the minute that Arsenal scored their goal. I think it was
70th minute for Walcott, 94th minute for Welbeck.
And by that point, I think that Ranieri probably tactically would have changed things differently had he had 11 men on the pitch, so that Arsenal wouldn't have been able to get into this position. Mm-hmm. So I think it would have played out very differently. But so I still think Arsenal would have scored one.
The changes Ranieri had to make, he had to sacrifice Riyad Mahrez to bring on Marcin Wesolewski to play right back. And then shortly after that, he sacrificed Shinji Okazaki to bring on Demarai Gray so that he would have two wingers, Gray and Albrighton. Kartik, before we go to Jamie Vardy's penalty, the penalty that he drew and then converted. I want to talk about the two Arsenal goals. To me, they were just supremely well executed goals. The header down that Giroud laid off for Walcott for the equalizer was just a great play on Giroud's part. And then the second goal, although you definitely have to blame Wesolewski for the foul that gave them the opportunity, just a sublime ball from Mesut Ozil right into that space in front of Kasper Schmeichel, and then the flick on for Danny Welbeck for the goal. Just two extremely well executed goals.
Yeah, I think obviously you can blame Wesolewski for the foul, but the reality is Welbeck lost his mark, and I know we've seen that time and time again in circumstances where a player where there's a late winner like that on a set piece, but two really well executed goals for Arsenal. Good football, pretty play, resilient play from the Gooners today. I think the officiating does weigh into how this result went. I do think Leicester deserved at least a draw in this match, but give Arsenal credit. They stood up, they were counted, their backs were against the wall. They were down 1-0 at halftime. Same scoreline as Manchester City last week. What was Manchester City's response? Just to take the afternoon off after that. Whereas Arsenal's response was to fight, to draw, to get Leicester to lose their composure, to draw that second yellow on Simpson. Although I think both were kind of harsh as bookable offenses. But the resiliency of Arsenal was to be admired today.
Let's talk about those fouls, and then we'll talk about the Vardy penalty a little bit more. Lawrence, do you agree with both of the yellow cards that Danny Simpson was given?
I honestly haven't seen enough replays to be able to assess that well enough, I think.
It's a really reasonable answer. Aren't we supposed to have strong opinions about everything on this show?
I think we're supposed to have well-assessed opinions, but for me, there are more critical points in the weekend. And red cards and yellow cards in games, I know... I didn't have enough time to go back and watch over and over again those things. For me, I think there are more critical points in the game than the sending off. Obviously, what I'm saying is I actually think that Arsenal would have pressed through in the end. And I think that overall, as much as it took them a while, there are so many truisms that you can relate about both sides this season. And I think for Arsenal, one of the truisms is sometimes it takes them a while to break teams down and work it out. But very often we just revert to, well, that came from the possession they had, etc. And if you look at the statistics, then, yeah, you know, Arsenal had 70% of the possession. But actually, I think they moved very quickly. And it was that movement and the way that, like you say, they used Giroud to move around that Leicester back line, which made the difference in the game. So for me, the sending off was less critical.
I completely agree with you. We can talk about this when we get to Everton, but one thing that dawned on me as I was watching the Everton game, just watching the Everton players take 3-4 touches as they're trying to break down a West Brom team that defended kind of like Leicester did with 10 men, even though West Brom had 11. And the speed with which Arsenal was moving the ball, moving without the ball, knowing where their players were going to be, really making it difficult for Leicester. Actually, now that I think about it, kind of surprising that Leicester was able to hold out for so long. But Kartik, let's go ahead and talk about the Jamie Vardy situation now. For people that missed it, Jamie Vardy approaching the penalty area from the right flank, one-on-one with Monreal. With the outside of his right foot, he plays the ball towards the goal line inside of the penalty area. Nacho Monreal had jabbed out towards him with his left foot, missed the ball. Vardy kind of continued his run into Monreal, lets himself get taken down. Very quickly, referee points to the spot. Kartik, to what extent do you agree it was the correct call?
Oh, it was the correct call. I mean, obviously, we've seen this before. We've seen Luis Suarez, we've seen other strikers do this, where they drag their leg looking for a call. But if there's contact, it's almost as if the contact is there and you're selling the referee. Is there some embellishment in it? Yes. But is it a foul? Yes.
Yeah.
Does it get called a foul outside the area? Yes. So why should an official judge what is called in the area differently than outside the area if we give penalty kicks for fouls inside the area? Now, I have been a long-term believer that the rule for penalties should be changed, and incidental fouls like that should not be penalty kicks in the area. They should be indirect free kicks. But as long as we have this set of rules, that's a penalty.
I didn't get here on NBC in the States. Robbie Musto was definitely against the call. Kyle Martino was for the call during the halftime analysis. I didn't quite get Robbie Musto's argument. I mean, basically, if you draw a line from where Vardy was running to where he would be running, it would go right through where Nacho Monreal put his leg. In other words, Monreal put his leg into his path. Now, if you take the alternate course and say, okay, well, Vardy was going to turn and go for the ball because there was a slight right turn, The leg is still in Vardy's path. There is just no way you can look at what Monreal did, and as incidental as it seemed, argue that he did anything but stick a leg into Jamie Vardy's path. And to me, that has to be a penalty, Lawrence.
Yes. Yeah, so it's almost, you're saying it's almost, because that's also part of the way the Premier League has become. I know you're talking about the quality, but also the speed of play can sometimes confuse certain players into making mistakes. Yeah. So like you say, as incidental as that seems, it ultimately is actually a tactic.
Yeah. You're still impeding his progress.
You're almost panicking the other side into making mistakes with their body in that way.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. And like you're implying, we have to give Jamie Vardy credit for being so tenacious, so frantic that he essentially caused Nacho Monreal to reach out with his left leg, not come close to the ball and take down Jamie Vardy. Even if Jamie Vardy, as you said, might have intended to be doing that all along and not necessarily intending to get around the man. So 2-1 was the result here. A last 30 minutes or so played without a man for Leicester. Let's talk about implications here quickly. Kartik, what do you think that this does for both sides? What do you think it does for their chances in the title race?
Well, it certainly opens the title race up. I'm actually working on, as we speak, as we record this, going through every fixture and figuring out who wins the title. I'm not quite...
I love that part of the season. It's the best bit when Kartik does that.
I don't like it that he's doing it during the show, though. I mean, we're trying to record a show here, Kartik.
Oh, no. I'm not doing it during the show, but I will resume it after. I'm only through about 32 rounds. I still got Leicester, I think, winning the title, but it's going to be close. And Spurs and Arsenal are both going to run them very close now. It opens that up. What I think it does psychologically is two things. One, for Arsenal, it shows them that when they have the fight, when they push forward, they can get it done. The doubters about Arsenal bottling it in big games, they now have some confidence that that's not always the case. For Leicester, you know what? This is the team that beat them 5-2 earlier in the season, and people thought that this game might be 4-1, maybe 5-1. This would be a hiding. This would expose Leicester. The reality is they stay 11-11. They at worst get a draw in this game. They know they played well. They know they played tenaciously. Ranieri was very proud of his team. He's giving them a week off now. They left it all on the pitch. He knows that. He was very emotional after the match. So I think it's funny because, of course, in the table, it helps Arsenal. But I think it's one of those games that, because of the way it was played, it helps both teams psychologically.
Lawrence, how did the result change how you look at the title race, if it changes it at all?
Really change it, to be honest. Structure is still the same in the Premier League. I understand the points difference between the two. For me, I guess the problem is you almost flip a coin on a lot of it's like the Iowa caucus, guys. You almost flip a coin on so many things, as a Kartik reference there for you. And so, you know, I'd love to know where Kartik's putting Liverpool's results come the end of the season. You still have a fairly interesting run for Leicester. I think that's what we were saying, is the fascinating side was we said Leicester's three critical games here. If they can get 3 points from these games, then they'll be grateful. Ultimately, they got 6, which is still, you know, a great achievement. But the point would be now they're facing teams who are maybe even more desperate for the points than they've faced in these three. So how do you work those out? And I think I've said it time and time again, but I don't know if you guys get this feeling as well. When I come down to listen to podcasts, look back at the weekend's results, most of the time I almost have a sense of deja vu, because I almost go, oh yeah, of course it worked out that way. Of course that was what happened. And you almost feel like there's a way of predicting that. But that's why I'm fascinated with where Kartik's going with that, predictions of where everything's, you know, sort of going to end up. Because I think it's so difficult to predict, but at the same time, it almost seems like the most obvious thing you could have.
The one thing I want to revisit that we've harped upon on the last two shows is Leicester's ability to win one-on-one battles and whether Arsenal could match them. And through the first half, I don't think that they did. I think particularly with N'Golo Kante, had a huge first half, tons of interceptions, tons of balls won in the middle. And we saw, particularly on the goal where Kante beat Koscielny to that ball just inside Arsenal's half, then Vardy beat Monreal to draw the penalty, Leicester was winning those one-on-one battles. What impressed me about Arsenal, in addition to the versatility that they were able to bring off the bench with Walcott and Welbeck, is that in the opening 10 minutes of the second half, they started winning those battles. And you can say Danny Simpson sending off was something that maybe doesn't happen every game. It clearly doesn't happen every game. Red cards are pretty rare. But Arsenal's ability to win one-on-one battles and draw those cards deserves some credit. It's not just incidental that Danny Simpson got those yellow cards. Arsenal had a part in that, and they deserve credit for winning the battles that put them
up. But one thing I have to say is that before Danny Simpson was sent off, every second ball, Leicester was winning. every 50-50, it seemed like Leicester was winning.
I think in the first half, but in the beginning of the second half, Arsenal seemed to have some renewed energy. I don't know if they were going to be able to keep that up. In fact, based on the broader look at the season, I would bet that that was going to be just a out-of-halftime burst, and then Conte and Vardy and Mahrez would assert themselves over the second half. But I was impressed by Arsenal's ability to come out of the locker room a little bit more inspired and kind of rise to the occasion, because as you mentioned, they went down a goal into halftime just as City had the week before, and rather than cowering to the challenge, they came out and really started to try to win those one-on-one battles, at least put a little bit more effort into them. And I think, as you said, Kartik, Arsenal deserves a lot of credit for that. Well, the round's other huge match, City and Spurs, gets the full treatment next segment, but there were eight other games this weekend, starting on Saturday when a late David De Gea own goal at the Stadium of Light allowed Sunderland to claim a key 3 points, beating Manchester United 2-1. That result allowed Southampton, now with 5 wins in 6, to close within 1 point of fifth place after their 1-0 win at Swansea. Stoke City, seemingly in a free fall coming into this weekend's round, reversed course at Bournemouth, claiming a 3-1 win at Dean Court. Watford got 2 goals from Troy Deeney to continue Crystal Palace's 2016 woes, winning 2-1 at Selhurst Park. West Bromwich Albion was outshot 33-5 and only put 1 try on target, but it was enough to beat Everton 1-0 at Goodison. Norwich looks set to jump back into the win column with 2 early second half goals, but West Ham woke up late to salvage a 2-2 at Carrow Road. And Saturday's last game, Newcastle made Chelsea their Valentines by gifting them 3 first half goals, with the defending champions eventually claiming a 5-1 win. On Sunday, in addition to those 2 huge top 4 battles, Liverpool unloaded on Aston Villa, getting 6 goals from 6 different players and a 6-0 win at Villa Park. The results leave the top 4 as we found it, albeit with a smaller margin at the top. Leicester comes through their terror run of fixtures with a 2-point lead at the top of the table, with Tottenham and Arsenal close behind. Manchester City stays 6 points back, still 6 up on 5th place United. At the bottom, despite their dramatic loss, Villa is still a little worse off in terms of survival. On 16 points, they're still 8 away from safety. 19th place Sunderland, however, is only 1 point from escaping the bottom 3, while Newcastle's nightmare at Stamford Bridge leaves the Magpies in 18th place. When we come back, we're talking City Spurs. Did Tottenham win over their doubters? Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. Second segment of the show, we usually go through the rest of the top of the table here, and we'll go ahead and do that now. It's just in this weekend where the top 4 squared off against each other, we only have one more top of the table matchup. And just like the early game on Sunday at the Emirates, the nightcap at the Etihad, it lived up to the hype. Surprisingly so, Lawrence. Tottenham 2-1 victory, late goal by Christian Eriksen, settling a tie that was created by Kaliche Iheanacho's equalizer in the 74th minute. Just in general, Lawrence, your thoughts on this one?
Let's go down the route of pressing with this one, as always, as we do with Spurs. It worked really effectively on Man City, and Man City almost allowed it for a little while. That's the weird thing that I always think about City. And the same, to some extent, with Arsenal, was sometimes they almost allow another team to enforce whatever it is they want on them. And then when they choose to up their game, then, you know, it almost looks too easy. I was questioning at the point where Spurs got the penalty, whether they were going to be able to press for that, or whether City were going to suddenly step it up like they did and create more chances and sort of, I mean, towards the end of the game, it really looked like City could equalize to me. So it wasn't as if it was, you know, Spurs imposing themselves. Again, the pressing worked. And pressing, we must remember, is not necessarily imposing yourself in the way that Man City might want to impose themselves.
Kartik, where should we start? Manchester City, how they dealt with Spurs pressure, or should we jump right in with the penalty call?
Well, regarding the penalty call, I think poor Manuel Pellegrini, there are a lot of people who want him to stay in England, but the all of these calls, the standard of officiating in the English game, I think is going to drive Pellegrini back to the continent. He seems so frustrated. There have been so many, and I always say, and Lawrence gives me a hard time about this, that these things tend to even out over the course of a season, but this might be one exception. Yeah. This Manchester City team this season might be one exception, because there seem to have been, at least in the last 6 weeks, a disproportionate number of calls that have gone against them. So, although some of those were in cup competitions, so maybe they don't all apply to the league race, but same officials, right? Same FA officials, English officials. So, yeah, I think he's feeling very bad about it. But Spurs were good. They were incisive. They were incisive going forward. I really like the idea of starting Son in midfield. I thought he had a very good shift, played very, very well. And Pochettino now has the right balance in this squad that he's able to bring guys off the bench and shut up shop when he needs or stimulate counterattacking goals when he needs to. He's got a plan B. He's got a plan C. We're going to talk about some managers in the relegation fight that may not even have a plan A later. And it seems like Pochettino's got it all figured out. He's thought through just about every scenario.
Yeah, we alluded to Arsenal's options coming off the bench in their win and how impactful they were against Leicester. Obviously, you just have to look at the score sheet there. Pochettino has a rotation of players in midfield, particularly now that he's working somebody like Tom Carroll in. He's even got somebody like Ryan Mason in reserve if he ever needs to go to him. But a lot of options in that midfield. And as you alluded to, starting Son today, when I think a lot of people maybe might have expected Eric Lamela to start, it just shows the options that he has to tactically match up with teams. But I want to go back to Lawrence's point regarding the pressing. And I think there's a very interesting point there about whether City is being imposed upon or whether they're letting teams impose upon them. And it's also something that Nipun and I talked a lot in the preview show, whether the quality that Manchester City has in their midfield now was going to be able to alleviate the pressure.
Also ask you one thing about that, guys?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was having a conversation earlier this week, and I don't know if we're the guys to have this conversation, but I thought it was so fascinating to have this, just the idea that, and then someone else agree with me. In England at the moment, there's a lot of analysis of players being lazy, in inverted commas. And
that sounds like a dangerous territory.
It is. And I worry a little bit that it is related to xenophobia and race. I don't know whether you guys have the same analysis. Now, the problem is that you guys have English pundits in America as well. So maybe they bring some of their cultural bias over with them. You know, I mean, Gary Lineker is a great pundit and I love the FA Cup. But the point would be that you still need to have something of a cultural foundation somewhere. I'm just wondering, do people speak about Yaya Toure, Daniel Sturridge, Divock Origi, Benteke, Sanya, any number of black players as ever being lazy players in the States?
Yeah, the Toure analysis, I think, is largely racist. I'll address that head on. I've felt that for a long time. He's 32 going on 33, and if it were a accomplished Spanish player, Santi Cartola is 31. Okay, well, maybe if you can think of an accomplished Spanish player or accomplished Italian player or English player of that age.
Pirlo was dipping at that
age. Right. Yeah. And Pirlo did about probably less running.
Lazy Pirlo, we haven't heard that.
Said Toure. And we never heard lazy Pirlo.
Go to NYCFC.
So there you go. I mean, on the Yaya Toure criticism specifically, I felt that for some time, and I haven't wanted to address it. I haven't wanted to tweet it. And thank you for bringing it up, Lawrence, because I think you're right.
But Lawrence is even bringing up another layer. This goes beyond just what fan reactions are, because in any fan reaction, you're going to get that slice of people who are just kind of ignorant. Lawrence is saying that this is bleeding over into the mainstream coverage of the sport in the UK. Yeah. Are you sensing any of that over here, Kartik? Because I'm not sure I've actually seen NBC or any other outlet, Fox, that covers the game over here go there regarding those kind of stereotypes.
No, I don't think they have. And I have to say, there are people who complain about American commentators. I complain about American commentators a lot also. But Kyle Martino, to me, makes some of the most sharpest points about this league that anyone is making anywhere in the world when I check out the coverage from around the world. So American pundits don't necessarily resort to those lazy stereotypes and that kind of cultural bias, and they can also analyze soccer. So that's a positive thing. I don't think our British pundits have gone to those points either, Lawrence. One thing I would say is that one of our most prominent pundits is Robbie Earle, and he happens to be black, so he's obviously not going to go there. But we don't have any of the old boys. I don't want to get into specific names, but we don't have any of those usual suspects that you have in the UK press over here just yet. We did at one point, but they're now both working in Qatar, the two I'm thinking of. But
don't know who you mean, Richard. Sorry, Kartik.
But we don't have any of those types yet here, so it hasn't seeped into our coverage.
Great. No, lovely, Andy.
Okay, let's go back to the game, gentlemen. It occurs to me we didn't...
I was going to make a wider point on that. Sorry.
Go ahead.
The point would be that because Yaya Toure is such a face of the team, people therefore almost use him as the personification of what the side represents.
Yes.
And that's that he can flex what he likes. And I think that, you know, to some extent, when I was analyzing it early on there, I sort of applied that same framework to the entire Man City team. And so I'm just wondering where that takes them towards the end of the season and how a title push is shaped through that. Because it's such a transitional, identity for this side. If some of them are thinking, look, I want to push to another side. I want to go somewhere else in Europe. Some people are thinking, I want to play in a Pep Guardiola system. So I have to, exhibit certain qualities. And some people just want to win a title. So there's a lot of factors pulling them from the outside as well as the inside. What I'm wondering is what it's like in Man City and what's going on there.
Hmm. I think that's very interesting. I think it's also very interesting that if you think some of that exists, then
we have a lot of fans that resort to the lazy stereotypes because they watch the UK press and they're saying Yaya Toure is the laziest player. He's a useless player. And then you get these, a different analysis of Mangala than you would of another center back of Otamendi. So I think there is some of that even in among supporters that there seems to be a quicker reaction. And we saw this with Liverpool, no offense, Lawrence, we saw this with Liverpool supporters towards Daniel Sturridge. I was offended by some of the reaction towards Sturridge. Oh, well, he's lazy. Benteke. He doesn't want to play.
And, yeah.
Benteke is a good one.
Yeah, Benteke is a great one.
He doesn't want to play. Really?
Yeah.
Daniel Sturridge doesn't want to play football? He keeps trying to fight back through all these injuries. He could have just retired by now and taken the money. Exactly. Really? I've been offended by what I've read the last couple of weeks about Sturridge.
It happens a lot. And the same with Divock Origi is, he just doesn't apply himself. No, he absolutely does. And it's the same with Benteke.
Right.
Is he's not willing to run. Or is the guy confused as to where his position is supposed to be? So instead of running like a headless chicken somewhere, he's actually confused as to where he's supposed to be on the pitch. And it's someone who's struggling to live up to all those things. But that doesn't fit the narrative of a certain striker. And I understand that, as a privileged white guy from wherever, maybe I'm not the guy to be championing that. But I still think it's sort of worth bringing up in the analysis, especially of City, against a side who previously were thought to be sort of mentally weaker because they didn't always last the course.
I didn't want to bring this up, since we just talked about that specific pundit that he in Britain is now in Qatar. But he made that analysis.
Well, guys, there are some people who listen to the show who might not know who we're talking about.
I'm talking specifically about Richard Keys.
Oh,
Richard Keys had John Cross on his BN Sports show, which comes from Doha, and basically threw out that allegation about Sturridge, much the same way that others were. I don't want to just single out Keys because I think Keys was just reacting to other things, other things that were being written. And Cross said, "You don't know Daniel Sturridge if you believe that." Basically,
exactly.
I've covered this guy with England. I've covered this guy with Chelsea. He with Liverpool. He is fighting. He's desperate to get back on the pitch. But reporters who actually cover these players know that, and they develop an appreciation for the players of African descent. However, there are pundits that don't develop that and are paid to be shock jocks or whatever term you want to use in the UK. That resort to these stereotypes, and then it seeps into the fan bases. That's a major problem for football. And I'm sorry we've gotten off on this topic, but it really is.
But it's something that I think is also quite important because there are a lot of young, prominent black players in the game at the moment. And Liverpool and Spurs and Man City have all got those guys becoming more and more prominent within the team. Look at the guy who scored the goal for City today. Look at the guy who's running the midfield for Spurs. Look at, I think it was four key Liverpool players, including Raheem Sterling at one point, who were all from South London and, not just white guys. So there's a lot to be said there as to what the perception is of all of these players, and especially for a team like Spurs, where Pochettino's come in and their reputation is now over hard work and fitness. And that's something that we haven't seen before in this iteration of the Premier League. I just don't think we've spoken about any other side in the way we speak about this Pochettino Spurs.
Interesting. I mean, those two adjectives that you just applied also apply to Leicester too. And I'm just wondering if we should be, kind of as you were hinting, doing a reset and really reevaluating how important fitness, hard work, willingness is to title winning teams. Because this year, that seems to be the theme of the whole season. The teams that are willing to outwork the other ones are at the top of the table right now.
Good point. Good point. Although you would say the makeup of the Leicester side is a very different age and demographic to the one of this Spurs side, which is why the analysis would fit differently. But fitness still stands there. Mm-hmm. You know, although Jamie Vardy's work ethic, you know, can't be called into question, you would say what most of people assume is Jamie Vardy's motivation might be different, say a Dele Alli or someone like that. But maybe that's just a false classist assumption from a middle-class white guy who's too lazy to look further into it.
It seems always dangerous when you start making assumptions about people's motivations. Better to just ask them about them and get them on record to tell you what motivates
and,
them.
And get a generic answer.
Well,
from a Dre Beats advert.
Yes, perhaps. But even if you get the generic answer, it probably isn't best to assume what the real motives are. Gentlemen, let's talk about Spurs for a little bit. There have been a lot of doubters with them, even as they've lingered in the top two for a couple of weeks now. Perhaps not as many doubters as Leicester had a month ago, but this overriding reputation of Spurs being a team that are going to fade away or find a way not to be real title contenders is something that a lot of people have found difficult to shake. Kartik, I'll start with you, and then I want Lawrence to answer this also. To what extent does that reputation linger with you as you evaluate this team?
As I evaluate it, it doesn't. I think the Spurs team's a legitimate title contender. Where I think it factors in is for Leicester City, top of the table, still, in spite of today's loss, and 2 points clear of Spurs, and for Arsenal, who are third in the table and are trying to chase down Spurs, their North London rivals, they don't have the fear factor they would if there was Chelsea on that shirt, or Manchester United on that shirt, or Manchester City on that shirt. I think psychologically it impacts the opposition to those teams. But for me, it doesn't impact my analysis.
Lawrence, how about you? And the point that Kartik makes, to what extent do you think that the lack of a fear factor is going to be an issue for Tottenham over these next 12 rounds?
I personally don't think it's going to be too much of an issue because of the way that I think people are reshaping the way they see other sides in the Premier League. Hmm. So I think the fear factor, like I say, the fear factor comes from an almost sort of barefaced honesty, if you like, of this Spurs side, which at times has seen them early on in the season perform in what looked like naive ways. Mm-hmm. And that's where they got so many draws from, for me at least. And I think that's changed because of the way that they've seen the effectiveness of Pochettino's system. Mm-hmm. Although I think they were almost seen as naive today against this Man City team again. Mm-hmm. And that'd be the issue. So maybe you're right. There's no fear factor because they're seen as a naive side. But at the same time, the fear factor is that if this Spurs team turn up and outwork you, then you're going to lose the game. Mm-hmm. So it seems very sort of binary in that sense.
Yeah. Some things that don't seem binary: Spurs only 2 points off the top, best goal difference in the league, best defense in the league, and now with 47 goals have only been outscored by Manchester City and Leicester. Both those teams have scored 48 times this year.
What do you think of the way that Tottenham's midfield is shaped? I'm really fascinated by the way that they've managed to accommodate all Eric Dier, Dembele, Ali in there, and all those players come to their best. Because at the beginning of the season, you'd say that maybe Ali and Dembele, and not Dier so much, and maybe even Eriksen in this formation would be conflicting in that position. Hmm. But actually, they've all been very complementary of each other. And all of them found space in that Man City midfield this afternoon, which allowed them to break forward in the way which ultimately pressed for the penalty and obviously the second goal.
Kartik, what do you think?
It's real interesting to see how Pochettino has been able to look at the assets of players, specific qualities of players, and shape a midfield around him. Not necessarily trying to cram people in a 4-4-2 or a 4-2-3-1, even though this kind of plays like a 4-2-3-1, it's very fluid in its movement. Eric Dier's role in the midfield is very important as a linchpin, and it gives Dembele kind of a freer role, which he's really excelled at. Keep in mind, Dembele's the one guy who's kind of a holdover player from the Harry Redknapp years that hasn't been weeded out of this. So he's obviously got a real role to play. How he's able to accommodate Son and Lamella at times, Nasser Chadli on the wing, a guy like Eriksen, giving him somewhat of a free role as well. And then really kind of Ryan Mason and Tom Carroll in spot duty very effectively. Tom Carroll's a guy who keeps the ball moving. He's a lot like a Leon Britton was at Swansea for many years. And he's a really good player to have when you're trying to hold the ball late in games and see out a game. And then Mason brings a little bit more of that, I hate to say it, Lawrence, since we've just had a discussion about it, but a little bit about that fitness and hard working in the midfield. Not as technical as Carroll, but he fits a role as well. Bentaleb as well. We haven't talked about him. So it's real interesting to see how he shaped this midfield. And I think he shaped the midfield around the personalities and the players' attributes that he has rather than trying to fit them into a system.
I think two keys that stand out for me is, one, Eric Dyer's ability to transition and really serve as an anchor in midfield that then allows for the second key, the positional versatility of Moussa Dembele, Dele Alli, and Christian Eriksen. Eriksen we think of as the creator at the top of that midfield, but he's a little bit different than Mesut Ozil in that he can still provide that creative presence if you start him on one of the flanks. Moussa Dembele, you can really deploy him anywhere in midfield. Same thing with Dele Alli. And what it allows, in my mind, is a really fluid kind of traditional three-man midfield where you have a ball winner, somebody that collects and plays the ball up to somebody who's then either making a run or is collecting the ball higher up the field. And I think those three guys kind of provide a lot of positional versatility to instill that three-man dynamic. If you have a team like Manchester City where you might want to deploy that dynamic higher up, it works. Maybe against an Arsenal, you deploy that tactic a little bit deeper because you want to focus on Mesut Ozil a little bit more. And maybe against other teams like hypothetically a Leicester, you want to focus on Riyad Mahrez a little bit more, so you shift it out towards a flank. The positional versatility of those three guys, while maintaining the anchor of Eric Dyer, I think really helps. And I think it also helps that players like Lamela and Son can play any of the three attacking roles as well as on either flank. I just think all that versatility really just develops a lot of kind of clubs that Mauricio Pochettino can pull out of his bag. And I think it's amazing to watch.
Yeah, good point. But it's very easy. I'm not saying it's very easy for you to say that, but it is very easy to just sort of say, well, they're just versatile. And, you know, they are. But I think there are a lot of sides which have versatile midfields who don't make them fit well together.
Right. They're versatile and complementary. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And good. Sometimes I think the same happens with Man City, which I think is what people are hoping Pep Guardiola will bring, which is a bit more structure in the first two thirds.
Well, everybody, Kartik alluded to the name value some of these teams still carry on their chests as teams like Liverpool, Manchester United, Chelsea go out to the other teams in the league. Next segment of the show, we're going to talk about those three teams. We're going to talk about West Ham, too, a team that still has some faint top four aspirations. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. When we last visited Germany, both Bayern and Dortmund were coming off rare 0-0 draws. You didn't think that would last, did you? On Sunday, Bayern raced back into the win column thanks to two goals from Robert Lewandowski, with a late goal from Augsburg's Raul Bobadilla providing the only blemish in a 3-1 win on the road. On Saturday, Dortmund had a tougher time, but carried Henrik Mkhitaryan's 57th minute opener through the final whistle, winning at home against last place Hannover 1-0. Elsewhere, Bayer's win at Darmstadt combined with Hertha losing at Stuttgart leaves those teams tied for third, with Schalke's Friday loss at Mainz dropping the Blues two back of Germany's Champions League spots. In Spain, Real Madrid stayed unbeaten under Zinedine Zidane with two goals from Cristiano Ronaldo, leading the Merengues to a 4-2 win over visiting Athletic on Saturday. The victory temporarily vaulted El Real into second, a position they gave back when Atletico kept another clean sheet on Sunday, winning at Getafe 1-0. That result briefly moved Atleti tied for first in La Liga with Barcelona, but Barcelona, with the final match of the weekend, scored five goals in the second half against visiting Celta Vigo, avenging their loss on the road 4-1 earlier this year with a 6-1 result. Barcelona, three clear at the top, still with a game in hand. In other news in La Liga, the story of Gary Neville took a turn for the positive. At home on Saturday against one of the worst teams in Spain, Valencia got their first league win since November, getting late goals from Alvaro Negredo and Denis Cherchev to defeat Espanyol 2-1. Players of the week, let's start with Kartik.
I have to go with Daniel Sturridge, especially after we had such a lengthy discussion about him and stereotypes about him earlier. But he, you know, when players come back from injury and from serious injuries and nagging injuries, it often takes them a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks to work back in to a routine and to be playing at a high level. With Sturridge, he looked very good when he came on in the FA Cup game on Tuesday against West Ham.
Fantastic.
He looked fantastic in that game.
As part of the front three, that was, I'd say, Liverpool's most dangerous front three of the season. Mm-hmm. Origi, Benteke, Sturridge. It's so unpredictable.
Yeah, well, Origi is a player that I think Jurgen Klopp likes an awful lot, and a big part of his plans if he could stay fit. And Sturridge might have worked his way back in. And then of course, today against Aston Villa, he just looked brilliant. There are very few players who have this quality around the world. Arjen Robben is a player I think of. Robben, actually, is how it's pronounced. But he's a player I think of that can come back from injury quickly and turn it on. But most players can't. It takes them a game or two or three to get those fitness levels up and make an impact. But Sturridge really showed me a lot, both in the FA Cup midweek, where Liverpool was eliminated on penalties, and then this game today against Villa.
Well, in a week that didn't have any standout obvious choices, maybe Conte would have been one if his team hadn't been reduced to 10 men pretty early in the second half. I'm going to use my privilege to pick somebody that's kind of, I don't know, a hipster choice or somebody that I just want to shine some light on. Mark Noble from West Ham. He's going to be in the highlight reels this weekend for that equalizer he had at Carroll Road. Finishing a shot that you see most people put into the crowd, just really good technique on a ball coming out of the box that he put into the right side of the net from about 24, 25 yards out. I think that gives us a good platform to talk about somebody that has been quietly one of the more sustaining above average players in the Premier League for some time. Mark Noble at various times has been overshadowed in West Ham's midfield by you can select a number of players, whether it be Dimitri Payet this year, Stuart Downing last year, even going back when the West Ham was going up and down, going back to the Scott Parker days. Mark Noble has always been the consistent player. He's always been the smart player. He's always been the person that has accommodated the other bigger names in the midfield. And to me, that means he's always been slightly underappreciated. I just think when I watch Mark Noble play that he's one of the more reliable players in that position in the whole league. And for somebody that's 28 years old, who was part of England's youth national teams, who now has been a regular at this level for 7 or 8 years, I just kind of scratch my head when I see somebody like Tom Cleverley has 13 caps for England, or Jonjo Shelvey has 6 caps for England, or Scott Parker even. I think he has something like 13 or 16.
Yeah, I don't know.
Caps.
I don't know why Mark Noble hasn't gotten a good look from England. I completely agree with that. In fact, I had this conversation with someone about 10 days ago, Rich, and I don't think it was you. I think it was someone else.
No, it wasn't me. But you look at Mark Noble, yeah, he does nothing great, but he also does nothing poorly, and he does almost everything above average, too. And I think on this occasion where he had a very important goal, it's a nice time to shine a light on him. So my player of the week is Mark Noble. Lawrence?
Nice. Can I go Troy Deeney?
You can, absolutely.
Go Troy Deeney with a penalty and then playing well this year in the game. One of my nominees, which I think was a really good nominee, but, just for almost welcoming to the Premier League, I'm going to go down the route of Mbula.
Mm.
What do you guys think?
I think that's great. When he was bought, I sent a tweet to Kartik saying, you know, it's ironic that Stoke is buying a player that hasn't scored a goal in something like 18 months at that point.
Exactly.
And he ended that streak with a very good finish. We're going to talk about Stoke next segment, but it was a very good result for Stoke this weekend, getting a 3-1 win at Bournemouth. Let's start with one that should be a pretty short conversation, guys. The one Sunday game we haven't talked about, Liverpool 6-0 win at Villa Park. Lawrence, I'll ask you about the Liverpool side of this. This is now a hint at what Liverpool can do with their full complement of attackers. We saw their attacking three today was Coutinho, Sturridge starting up top, and Firmino also completing that three. How indicative of Liverpool's future is this? Obviously, they're not going to score 6 goals every time, but in contrast to some of the down performances we've seen over the last couple months from the Reds, this has to be a very encouraging output.
Yeah, good point. I would definitely go down the route with Liverpool of that Klopp sort of said everything went right for Liverpool today. Mm. And I'd be inclined to agree. Villa just didn't put up any form of defence on this one for most of the goals. And I think Liverpool found it quite easy. The good thing is, obviously it's a confidence boost for Daniel Sturridge coming back, to have Origi be able to come on. I think there's a lot of good factors. And then obviously for Liverpool to keep a clean sheet, also fantastic. How much can you actually read from this game? Very little, because, when you look at the statistics, when you look at the way they played out, Villa were at home and they barely put up anything on this.
But Liverpool is within 3 points of Manchester United at this point. So I don't know exactly what that means, but it is kind of a barometer. Manchester United is in fifth place, and for all the struggles Liverpool have been having, they're not that far out of touch from securing a place back in Europe. Kartik, I want to ask you about the other side of this coin, Aston Villa. You know, as far as their fight for survival is concerned, they didn't actually lose any ground this weekend. Newcastle lost. They're still Villa is still 8 points from safety. So the real damage here, if there is damage, is going to be psychological. So how much psychological damage do you think was dished out by Liverpool on Sunday?
Might be a fatal blow. It's difficult to come back from this when you're already in a position where you need to take of the remaining 36 points that are on offer, right? Am I right? 36? You need to take maybe 22 points from that, realistically, to stay up, 21, 22 points. So you don't have much margin for error. And it was just an absolutely lethal blow, I think, psychologically.
Let's go to a team that's dealing with their relegation battle markedly better, Sunderland. We've been talking about this on the show for the last couple of weeks. Sunderland put in very good performances against both Manchester City and, to maybe a lesser extent, against Liverpool, but they were very opportunistic at the end of that match at Anfield. So it probably isn't a huge shock to us that Sunderland got a 2-1 result against Manchester United, moving them to 23 points, only 1 point from safety at this point. Kartik, talk about the performance you saw from the Black Cats.
I really like what we're seeing. Karziri, who you would tip when he signed with Sunderland, really good signing. What we saw from Kone on the back line has been encouraging. Damian Doi, who's come in from Turkey, has played well in kind of an unfamiliar role for him, because I think when Allardyce signed him, he wanted him to play him centrally, and because Jermaine Defoe found form, he's found a way to work both those guys in. I really like the way Sunderland is playing. I have to say, there were times in this match at Old Trafford, they took the game to Manchester United. They seemed unafraid. DeAndre Yedlin, the American, with the exception of Martial's goal, had a pretty solid game. Best game he might have had as a Premier League player since moving from MLS 2 years ago.
He sure did show England how fast he can be. Jeez.
Yeah.
Like four or five different times he broke out from his right back position, carried the ball 20 or 30 yards, invariably lost it. But geez, he might be the fastest player in England.
He could be. And I think this is going to be an important thing. Newcastle versus Sunderland, rivals 8 miles apart, 10 miles apart, whatever the distance is. Sunderland has beaten them six successive times. They both managed to stay in the league the last couple of years, and both have been tipped this season for relegation. Sam Allardyce goes out during the January window, goes and buys four guys that are prominent from the continent at pretty cut-rate prices, right?
Yeah.
Because you find better bargains on the continent. Steve McLaren makes the decision to bring in Andros Townsend and Jonjo Shelvey, both of which are decisions I question, to be perfectly honest with you, given how those guys had played at their previous clubs. And given that Townsend is the only guy that's an English player that's gotten games for the England national that Pochettino just kind of discarded at Spurs. I think that's pretty telling for me. But they've decided to go with those two guys, spend a lot more money on those two guys than Allardyce did on the four guys he bought from the continent. We're going to see who gets relegated and who stays up. I think one of those teams is going to go down and one of them is going to get relegated, is going to stay up. And right now, I would give Sunderland the advantage.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about Newcastle. Newcastle, along with Aston Villa, the two teams on the wrong end of just embarrassing results. Newcastle losing 5-1 at Stamford Bridge. Defensive errors and absent-mindedness leaving them down 3 goals at halftime. I want to just read the lead from Dominic Fifeld's match report for The Guardian. I think it kind of sums it up, because it also injects what you were talking about, Kartik, with their Newcastle's January spending. It takes performances as pathetic as this to drain any optimism generated by a lavish mid-season outlay on attacking talent. Newcastle United looked a depressingly dysfunctional side here, a team devoid of defensive steel as they crumpled obligingly to present Goose Henick with a first league win at home in his second spell as Chelsea's interim manager. Subsiding in these parts might normally not be cause for huge alarm, but the champions have not been permitted to purr like this all season. Lawrence, I think that sums it up. Newcastle made Chelsea look good, and Chelsea might actually be good at this point. We'll have to wait and see, but they made Chelsea look better than any of us thought that Chelsea could look at this point.
I think Chelsea were just allowed to impose themselves on the game because of the formation that Newcastle played as well. I think they were slightly overawed. They didn't seem to, like you say, have much control of the midfield. And as much as they bought in Jonjo Shelvey to solidify things, I don't think they've found him a partner who's going to give him that sort of the solid partner he needs, if you like.
Yeah.
Cheick Tiote's not that right now. And, you know, for that reason, I think that they need a bit more structure within the team. Consistently, when Newcastle don't play well, it's down to a poor structure and setup of the side.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Tiote had a very poor game. Shelvey is a very distinct kind of player. And we saw in Shelvey's first game against West Ham when he first got acquired, if you give him time, he can do damage. He can spray the ball across the park. But if that skill isn't being beneficial on a day, he isn't really that much value to you as a team.
Exactly.
Kartik, what were your impressions of Chelsea?
I thought Chelsea were very good. This is the first time I've seen Pedro look as rampant as he did in his Barcelona days. And it was an interesting tweak to put Pedro in the team. Mikel was dropped to the bench. A little more openness from Heating. Possibly we knew how poor Newcastle were and how bad they'd be. But very, very good signs from Chelsea were in these last few weeks. Diego Costa looks a new player. We talked about this last week, Richard. I don't want to necessarily get into the conspiracy theories about him trying to get Mourinho sacked and all those speculations that have come out. Maybe just Heating puts him in a better position to score goals. Maybe Heating is better for him in training and he's more motivated. But he looks right now as good as any striker in England. And then I'm including Harry Kane and Jamie Vardy in that. So Costa looks the same player he did 2 years ago at Atleti, really the first time in his Chelsea career he has. And it was all good for them. But you have to keep in mind, Newcastle defensively is a disaster. And even though they went out and spent all this money in January, they did not do anything to shore up their defense. They did not go out and get a guy like a Kone, a defender that Sunderland did, or Kirchhoff, who Allardyce is playing in the midfield but could play on the back line. They needed to get a player like that. They just look so fragile. And for the first time, I'm thinking Newcastle's going to go down.
Newcastle, to me, looked like a team that hadn't had a full speed training session in a couple of weeks. They looked like a team that it took them half an hour to realize how hard the other team was going to play. And, you know, Diego Costa's finish for that first goal was a great finish. But everything that led up to that opportunity looked like one team playing at full speed against another team that maybe didn't stretch or something. I mean, it looked like something basic was wrong with the team, and unfortunately led to a really lopsided result for the Magpies. One more match to talk about in this segment, Norwich 2, West Ham 2. Norwich getting goals from Robbie Brady, Wes Houlihan, then quickly responded to by Dimitri Payet and Mark Noble. Lawrence, I want to ask you just generally about West Ham, because I think West Ham is a team that a lot of people haven't been able to get a good handle on, how good they actually are. We've seen them, you know, particularly early in the season, road wins at Manchester United, Liverpool, Manchester City, I should say, Liverpool and Arsenal.
Liverpool three times this season, yeah.
Yeah, but then we also see like the first 65 minutes of this game, their performance against Newcastle a couple of weeks ago. There seems to be another side to West Ham that comes out every once in a while. So what's your reading on how good the Hammers actually are?
I think it's when they can't get the part of it comes down to structure for me. As much as most people are laying them out as a sort of weird 4-3-3, I think it's more like a 4-4-2 sort of thing. And I was talking to a couple of guys about this over the last few weeks, and a lot of people struggle to see where a lot of opportunities come from without Dimitri Payet as part of the overall structure. So I think if you shut him down, generally you have a pretty good chance of sort of stifling a lot of their game. I know that seems quite reductionist, but at times,
this game, I mean, when Payet woke up after the second goal, he scored a goal. He helped create the second goal. That was a huge difference in this game. And I think a lot of West Ham fans will point to the last couple months where Dimitri Payet, after he came back from injury, hasn't been at his early season peak. And that maybe explains some of the inconsistency in West Ham.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it also comes down to the fact that when other midfields allow them to play the exact structure they want to play, then it works very well for West Ham. Outside of that, I think they can struggle. But the problem is that, you know, when other midfields do play this kind of team, then they it's very easy to break down a lot of midfield shapes at the moment in the Premier League. And I think when West Ham play well, they have a very good midfield structure and they tend to exploit the holes in the other sides. This is what we found though against Norwich. I mean, if you look at that Norwich formation to kind of match that up, they almost played a 4-4-1-1. I think at times that was very stifling to the way that West Ham were looking to play.
Well, everybody, we're going to take our last break right now. When we come back, we'll update you on the championship, give you our top fours, and then talk about the other four matches in the 26th round in the Premier League. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk podcast. Down to the championship, where Middlesbrough were poised to reclaim their lead at the top of the table, making up their game in hand on Tuesday at MK Dons. But in the face of a three-game winless streak, Itor Karanka's team failed to make significant progress, needing a 93rd-minute goal from Jordan Rhodes to claim a 1-1 draw. That result, however, meant Borough went into the weekend 1 point up on second-place Hull, a gap see Bruce's side closed on Saturday. With early second-half goals from Abel Hernandez and Mohamed Diame, Hull rebounded from last weekend's loss at Burnley to take a 2-0 win at Blackburn. With Middlesbrough facing a Monday match at Leeds, Hull is temporarily 2 points clear at the top, but the race for those two automatic promotion places continues to be a tight one. In third, Burnley are still within 3 points thanks to a 0-0 draw at Reading, while Brighton is now also three back after a 3-2 win over visiting Bolton gave them their fourth victory in a row. Further down, Sheffield Wednesday is fifth, unbeaten in seven after a 4-0 win over visiting Brentford, while Derby's first match after firing Paul Clement ended in a 1-0 loss at home to MK Dons. The Rams are still holding onto that sixth place spot. Time for our top fours, everybody. I drew the short straw on this one, and I'm going to go first. Although in recent weeks, we haven't seen a lot of variation amongst these lists, so you might end up hearing these four over and over again amongst us. But on form, first I have Tottenham, 5 wins in a row, very convincing win this weekend. Second, I have Leicester. Even though they lost this weekend, I think we all know the circumstances behind that one and got to give them credit for the run they just went through. Southampton has won 5 of 6, has the best defense in the league right now. I have them third. Arsenal, I think, is fourth on this list, but still playing very, very well. Most of the time this year, they would have been first on this list. So many times we get to this list and we wonder if there are any form teams in the league. Right now we have a few. End of the season, I will go 4-1 here. Number 4, Manchester City. I am starting to question whether Southampton has time to track them down, although Manchester City did play reasonably well this weekend against a tough opponent. Number 3, Arsenal. Number 2, Spurs. I have Leicester number 1. Lawrence?
Oh, I'm almost going to match you up team for team, aren't I? Yeah. And your logic as well. So what, I guess my end of season will be different.
Okay.
I want to go Spurs top.
Ooh.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I think Spurs will ace it from here out due to improved mentality.
Sounds good. Well, it's good that we're not all thinking exactly alike. Kartik, your lists.
Yeah, I'm going to go the same similar top four on form: Southampton, Leicester, Spurs, Arsenal. End of season, I'm going Man City 4, and I want to point out that had Liverpool beaten Manchester United in the game they should have won a couple weeks ago at Anfield, I think Liverpool could have chased down Manchester City. Instead, that 6-point swing leaves a weaker Manchester United as the team chasing Manchester City. They won't catch them. So 4 Man City, 3 Arsenal, 2 Spurs, 1 Leicester, although I'm beginning to hedge on 1 and 2, thinking maybe it's Spurs 1, Leicester 2, but one more week I'll go Leicester 1, Spurs 2.
Gentlemen, I don't think you'd be surprised to hear that right after the result on Sunday, I started getting tweets from Arsenal fans who were justified.
Yeah, I did too.
They were justifiably happy with their team's results. I think it was Robbie Musto that pointed out that Arsenal still has to go to they still have to go to Spurs, they have to go to United, they have to go to Everton, and I believe they have to go to City. So
yeah, they still have to go to Manchester United next week, so they could get back the 3 points they got today. And Leicester is playing West Brom at home. Probably it'll be 4 or 5 points at that point.
Yeah.
Gap again.
Arsenal will visit Manchester United on the 28th. Next week, we still have to figure out what to do with our shows next week. Just like any week where the Premier League is going to be off, we're going to have to think of some creative topics because we are a primarily Premier League show. We're still going to come to you with shows midweek and at the weekend, just this coming weekend. We won't be doing a Premier League show, and we'll probably only be kind of tipping our hats to the FA Cup. Gentlemen, 4 more games to talk about. Southampton, we've mentioned a couple times during the show. We just mentioned them in all of our form lists. They got a 1-0 victory at Swansea. Shane Long's 69th-minute goal was the only scoring there. Southampton has the best defense in the league right now. They've won 5 of 6. And I'll ask both of you guys this. The gap between Southampton and Manchester City is 7 points. There are 12 rounds to go. Southampton is playing as well as any team in the league right now. Is there enough time for Southampton to track down Manchester City? Kartik?
Well, there certainly is, and Manchester City have a ton of points they're going to drop the rest of the way. But I just wonder if Southampton were basing it on their recent form and not what we saw before that. And I just don't think they will track them down. Is there time? Yes. And as I said in the just now, if Liverpool were sitting at that point where they should have been, if they had won that game against Manchester United, I think they probably would chase down Manchester City. Now that Liverpool has got a fit Sturridge, a fit Origi, and a understanding of how Klopp wants them to play consistently from game to game. But Southampton, I think, maybe a bit too much to ask. They could finish fifth, though.
Mm-hmm. So let me just read down the fifth through eighth spots in the league right now to give people an indication of just how tight it is. Manchester United on 41 points is 6 points back of Manchester City for the league's final Champions League spot. Right behind them with 40 points, both Southampton and West Ham, and then only 2 points back of them, Liverpool. But Lawrence, I want to ask you the same question. Does Southampton have enough time? And just to note, very recently between Boxing Day and now, they've taken 4 points from Arsenal. So if there is a complaint as to whether they're taking advantage of a weak fixture list or not, they have the better of one of the league's title contenders during this span.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Why would they not be able to track down a 7-point difference there? I'd say the only difference is with Southampton is when you look back at their fixtures and some of the fixtures they've had more recently, they've been very narrow. So they got 1-0s, 0-0s, 1-0s, 0-0s. And then the last thing they got was against West Brom, which I acknowledge is a hard team to break down. The good thing and the difference again would be number of fixtures, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the number of fixtures and the difference between the two. If Man City are going towards the end of the season, they've obviously still got the final against Liverpool. They've also got the Champions League, which they may immediately go out of. But it's still that fixture management, which I imagine is going to be the difference.
Hmm. That's true.
Yeah, and so, I should point out Manchester City. Don't think about August and early September. If you take from this point, from middle of September onward, they're no different than any of these other teams. They're an eighth place team, a seventh place team. So maybe as you're talking about this, you're convincing me.
Yeah, and maybe that somewhat fortunate draw they got in Champions League. I know, Kartik, that you've written about how Dynamo Kiev is not going to be a pushover, but it is still a better option than some of the other.
They
could have gotten PSG in that spot. I believe that was one of the options. Right. But City is going to be the favorite in that matchup. Maybe they get the winner of Wolfsburg and Ghent in the next round and get a paved path to the Champions League semifinal. And maybe that actually comes back to haunt them a little bit. Maybe they then run into a Real Madrid, get eliminated, and find themselves in sixth place in Premier League.
This is going to be sacrilege. This is going to be sacrilege to a lot of people because we know about the romance of the FA Cup. But there is a school of thought among Manchester City supporters to just, since we drew Chelsea mm-hmm. in the fifth round at Stamford Bridge.
Pellegrini even alluded to that in his quotes today.
He said
that he needs to make some smart decisions in lieu of the fact that Europe is now coming up and they have a final and they have the FA Cup. He says he needs to make some smart decisions with his roster.
Yeah, so I'm expecting a youth squad to play against Chelsea, quite frankly.
Mm. Well, they had pretty much a whole youth squad on the bench today, so maybe that's just a matter of one step up.
Right.
Gentlemen, let's talk about Stoke City versus Bournemouth. 3-1 victory. This looks great on paper for Stoke City. It's a great way to kind of stem this tide here. Kartik, the one thing that really jumps out to me about this is that the shots were even 11-11. Stoke had the much better quality of shots, but the possession number is one that people that are hoping Stoke will evolve into Stoke Alona kind of defies. 34% possession, and to me, this is how Stoke really should be playing. Not really trying to hold the ball, but trying to get their very talented people out on the break and into outnumbered situations where they can really take advantage of that talent gap between them and a team like Bournemouth.
At one-on-one situations, just like you've talked about with Leicester for weeks now. Leicester wins those one-on-one battles with every team in the league. Stoke can win those one-on-one battles with most of the league. So this was a smart way of playing. Bournemouth had so many chances in this game. I watched a lot of this game. It was really kind of the most intriguing for me of the 3 p.m. kickoffs. And Bournemouth was wasteful. Their finishing was suspect. And defensively, they still have some concerns when they get caught out that way. And when they're keeping the ball, we have seen Bournemouth adjust because Eddie Howe's teams in the Championship and in League One, they kept the ball 66-34 is a usual possession number for them, 60-40. But we've seen some pragmatism from them this season when they played better teams, when they don't keep the ball defensively, they keep their shape. When they did have the ball in this game, their defensive shape was terrible.
Yeah, kind of a letdown here for Eddie Howe's side. You'd have to think before this game, he was hoping to get 3 points from this one, continue building that gap between his team and relegation. As is, they end up losing at home. Lawrence, you haven't been on the show in a couple of weeks, so we haven't had our Tony Pulis defender here. So I think we need a little bit of a balance, because Kartik and I have gotten just more and more negative about West Brom. West Brom got a victory this weekend. It wasn't pretty at all, but it was the plan.
Expected? Oh.
Given the opposition, they were at Goodison. But it was the plan. Early goal, hold out, use that defensive solidity that they work on so much to get 3 points. And to, in that light, probably deserve some credit.
Yeah, although, you know, they obviously in that time they also conceded a lot of shots.
yeah, and, 33. Know, but,
so it's not the defensive solidity, maybe, that we, you know, in terms of shots created and chance creation, I think they were fairly fortunate in that sense. I'm not going to try and defend what Pulis is doing, because I don't think I need to. It's a tactic of sorts. And, you know, as ugly as some people might call it, I still think it has its place in the Premier League.
Kartik, I want to get your thoughts on Everton in a second, but the one thing I want to do is follow up on my comments earlier in the show when we were talking about Arsenal, and Arsenal using two touches to try to break down a bunkered-in Leicester team. We didn't see that with Everton, and it goes back to something we've been talking about throughout the year with Ross Barkley. To me, Ross Barkley has been one of the better midfielders in the year this season, but we have talked to him about him maybe not fully developed as a tempo setter at this point, somebody that is like a Mesut Ozil that can play the ball around quickly and force defenses to react quickly. Ross Barkley, to me, was the biggest example of somebody that when the ball was coming to him, he was taking too many touches, allowing West Brom to set up their defense and allowing West Brom to only react to the ball and not react to the players around the ball because it wasn't moving fast enough. And I think that's if Everton looks at this game, it'll be a good example of how they can improve. It's a good example of why Everton seems to falter against teams that let them have possession, and Everton seems to be so much better on the break. This is a game that Everton should have found a way to win. But Kartik, in general, I think a lot of people are going to look at this game as kind of an indicator of some of the problems in the Martinez era for the Toffees. To what extent do you read into that?
I do, because again, I think they're taking too many touches on the ball. They're not, when they've got their chances, when they've got the daylight, you can't let that defense set, which is what happens when you play a Pulis team. So you have to be, there were a couple times where they had, where Barkley specifically, you mentioned him, was in space, had a player making a run, could have created a one-on-one opportunity, could have goal scoring opportunity, and the ball was pulled back, or too many touches were taken, or the ball was played late, or the wrong ball was played. So this is part of having a plan B. This is part of understanding how to break down a bunkered side. Quite frankly, years of Martinez at Everton, we haven't seen him be able to do it yet with consistency.
Mm. And then the final match of the weekend, not the final match, but the one we haven't talked about yet, Troy Deeney's two goals earning him Lawrence's Player of the Week nod in their 2-1 victory at Selhurst Park over Crystal Palace. But Lawrence, I really want to talk about Crystal Palace here, because we haven't spent enough time really talking about what's going on right now with them. Palace, a team that was challenging top four, top five spots a couple months ago. They were there. Maybe they weren't challenging, but they were there. Yeah. Now they're in 13th place, and they're playing like a team that's more relegation standard. They can't remember the last time they actually won. What's going on with them right now?
I think it's partly the structure of the front line, and that they seem a little bit blunted by the fact they can't find very much shape in the front. They brought in Adebayor, and obviously he got the goal on the weekend, but you've got to be more consistent than that. And if, you know, the Premier League, you're very likely to concede more than one goal. Mm. What I'm thinking is with Palace is basically, you know, we've warned about this. And I think we said it from the very beginning of the season. The way that Pardew motivates the players can sometimes, and always in the moment, is always lauded as this fantastic, you know, he's really getting the best out of them. But how much longevity is there? And, you know, you can compare that to Mourinho in a sense.
Well, in Palace's defense, they are playing without Yannick Bolasie, Yohan Cabaye, and James Puncheon, as is this. This downturn in form has transcended a lot of those injuries. And I think a lot of people are asking if Pardew's going through another one of his moments that we've seen in other spots. Midweek action this week focuses on Champions League. Of course, Europa League is Thursday, but between now and then, we are going to be coming to you with another show. On Tuesday, though, in Champions League, Chelsea travels to Paris Saint-Germain. Big issue there is whether John Terry, who had to leave this weekend's game with a hamstring strain, is going to be able to play. If not, look for Cahill and Ivanovic to start in central defense there. Baba Rahman being brought in at fullback for what is a very important game for them. Also on Tuesday, Zenit St. Petersburg visits Benfica. On Wednesday, Ghent versus Wolfsburg is one game. And then Roma, Luciano Spalletti gets a visit from Real Madrid. We are going to be back with you midweek with another show talking a little bit about Champions League. Looking forward to the weekend in England. But until then, for everybody at the World Soccer Talk podcast, I'm Richard Farley. For Lawrence McKenna, Kartik,
enjoy your football.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737. Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast. And Nipun is Nipun Chopra 7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email. Richard@worldsoccertalk.com.